When you're traveling abroad, how much you spend really won't determine how well you eat when you go out to dinner. Don George has assembled stories of life-changing food adventures around the world in his latest book. It's published by Lonely Planet, and it's called A Movable Feast. The book includes essays from Anthony Bourdain, Simon Winchester, Jeff Greenwald, Jan Morris, Pico Iyer, and 33 other contributors. Don also writes for and edits the websites for Adventure Collection and Geographic Expeditions. Don, thanks for joining us.
It's wonderful to be here, Rick.
Don, what a cool book, 38 courses. Now, you selected essays from 38 travel writers, not all famous travel writers, a lot of people who are not well-known. Tell me just the goal of your book, the criterion for choosing these 38 edible courses to lace together for this package.
Well, the idea was that we all eat when we travel, and people eat in different ways. But you know, I'm a lifelong traveler and travel writer, and I know that food for me is one of the great pathways into a culture. And I asked a number of other travel writers if they had any great food experiences that kind of illuminated the same theme. And everybody had some kind of story that they wanted to tell about an unforgettable meal here, a really tremendous act of kindness involving food at somewhere. So it was easy to put the stories together, and it was wonderful that it turned out to be a food tour of the entire world with no particular emphasis on any region or another, just great stories of food in all kinds of different situations, helping to open up a place and a people and a culture to travelers.
Now, when I looked at your book and I realized it's essays by 38 travel writers on their favorite food experiences, I kind of thought, okay, we're going to get like 38 restaurant reviews and a description of 38 meals. But much more than that, it's more than the food that's on the plate. It's the whole context, isn't it? The cultural context.
It is absolutely all about the context. Sometimes the food is almost lost in the ritual around the food. I mean, it may be a very simple piece of bread or a piece of fruit that's the food involved, but the context of that food, how it's offered, how it's consumed, that's what becomes really the richness of the story. And it makes you realize that food plays roles in our travels in so many different ways. It's not all about five-star meals. It's about food in all of its manifestations. And that's one of the things I love about the book.
You write in your book that food nourishes us not only physically, but intellectually, emotionally, and spiritually too. What do you mean by that? How does food nourish us other than physically?
Well, it becomes a communion, a real act of communion to sit down with someone and take a meal with them. Suddenly you're doing much more than just consuming nutrition. Someone went to the market and bought that food. Someone brought it back to a kitchen and prepared it. They sliced it and diced it and cooked it. They used local seasonings. A meal becomes an education, you know, a course in the local culture. And then you start to talk to people about the food and about their appreciation of the food. And so food just becomes nourishing on all those different levels of human contact and creation. And that's what I love about it. There's one story in the book that I love where a disgruntled traveler ends up going into a restaurant where there's all these local people and they ask him to join them. And he ends up, it's a group of doctors who get together every Sunday, and he's just invited into their feast and he's embraced as one of them, and he ends up having one of the best meals of his life. And it turns his whole day around and it teaches him something about Portugal and doctors in that town that he never, ever otherwise could have learned.
Yeah, Jim Benning, who runs the World Hub website, he wrote a fascinating essay in your book on Tijuana terroir. And of course, terroir is this concept in France where you've got the culture and the earth and the sun and everything that's sort of all swizzled into that wine. And you just, when you drink it, you're connecting with the salt of the earth. He was having a carnitas, which he said you could have just as well in San Diego, just across the border. But in Tijuana, it was like the place to have it. And let me just read this because it's just so fun. And then it hit me why I'd come to Tijuana for lunch. He just crossed over on the tram from San Diego. Sure, I could have probably found the same beautiful carnita back in San Diego, a city known for its great Mexican cuisine, but we don't eat food in a vacuum, and there's more to a meal than the sum of its ingredients. Much like the terroir of winemaking, the connection between grapes and the unique soil and the climate they grow in, there exists a kind of cultural terroir related to our food. To eat ethnic food in the place that gave it life and to immerse oneself in the history and culture of that place can transform an otherwise mundane meal into an extraordinary experience. Isn't that great?
I love it, yeah.
You write, food can be the doorway to the heart of a tribe.
Yes, precisely. There's actually a story in the book that illustrates that theme. There's an adventurer, Lawrence Millman, is on the Micronesian island of Faiz, and he ends up eating the local specialty, which is grilled bat. Not something you find on your normal menu here in the United States, but because he is open-hearted enough and open-minded enough and, I guess, open-stomached enough to partake in that local delicacy, suddenly the tribe embraces him as one of their own. He becomes a kind of a son of Faiz by doing that. And it's happened to me all around the world. In Greece, I was honored at the Easter festival when they offered me the eyeballs of the lamb. That's the great honor. Guests gets to eat the eyeballs. And of course,
now, wait a minute. Really what is that? Not only what does it taste like, what does it feel like to chew an eyeball of a lamb?
It's kind of like eating silly putty, I guess.
Did it pop in your mouth?
No, I made sure it didn't pop in my mouth, actually.
Do you slice the
eyeball? Eating a grape. It's kind of like eating a grape and not biting down on it. You just let it slide down. That's what I was told.
And they weren't just pulling a prank on you and having you eat something nobody else eats?
No. And you wonder about that, but no.
It's probably the delicacy.
It is the delicacy. I knew from my readings that this is the delicacy, and if it gets offered to you, you're incredibly honored, and there's nothing to do but swallow the eyeball. So
swallow the eyeball.
I did it. And I did feel honored. I felt like I suddenly was a part of this Greek mountain village in a way I hadn't been before.
Now, you write about, that tradition where they shatter the plates. Of course, they do that in tourist places, in the Plaka in Athens. But have you been in a small town in Greece where they're actually shattering plates not for tourists?
Yes, I've been in the middle of nowhere in Greece where people ended up doing what you think is the most touristing thing ever, linking arms in a circle and dancing drunkenly around a restaurant, and at the end of that, flailing the plates into the fireplace. Everybody was doing it, and I was the only tourist there, so I'm pretty sure that this was a genuine plate-throwing festival. It was great.
I love that. When you've got something that in your mind is just a crass touristic cliché, and then you find yourself in some, godforsaken corner where it's never seen a tourist, and you realize, hey, locals are doing this cliché for themselves, not for the tourists.
Right. I guess this is why it became a cliché, because they really do it out
really
here.
They really do break the plates. Don George is our guest at the table right now on Travel with Rick Steves as we explore memorable food-related moments in our travels. Don's the editor of a collection of travel essays for Lonely Planet called A Movable Feast. Contributors include Anthony Bourdain, Jan Morris, Pico Iyer, and Andrew McCarthy. By the way, you can send us a paragraph about the surprises that appeared on your plate overseas. There's a link for your comments in the radio section of ricksteves.com. How do you, when you're traveling, look for a restaurant that'll be a good value and a good experience?
One of the things I have found most successful is asking locals, especially going just into a shop where, a normal shopkeeper who probably doesn't make a whole lot of money, and say to them, if you wanted to go out and have a special meal, not spending a lot of money, but have really good food in this neighborhood, where do you go? They're going to tell you, and since they're local, they live there, they've had a lot of years of experience to filter out the good from the bad. I've never gotten a bad steer from doing that, and I always end up having a really good experience. And once in a while, the person will engage in conversation, and they'll actually say, you know what, I get off work at 6 o'clock, why don't you meet me here and we'll go out together? So suddenly you've got a local guide who you've befriended, and the whole evening can turn really magical after that. So that's my tip.
I just did that in Verona, in Italy. When I'm updating my guidebooks, I spend a lot of time sitting there at the desk talking to the tourist information person, and I really enjoyed this one guy. And I had, he was very helpful, and I thought, he's cool. I wish he was my friend. And then I got about a block away, and I literally stopped. I turned around. I went back, and I said, would you like to go to dinner with me tonight? He jumped at the opportunity. And we had a marvelous evening. And what I learned was these Italians are just really poetic and romantic about their food. And I was just scribbling notes on all the paper tablecloths all around. And it actually became an article that I was able to write because I had befriended a local.
That's really great.
Another trick when you're traveling, I think, is to remember that Don said, make friends and invite him out. Another thing would be to go to the markets. And I find around the produce markets, you've got all sorts of little eateries that are patronized by the local shoppers and the people who work in the market. And invariably, they're great values.
One of the most famous markets is the fish market in Tokyo, Tsukiji. If you get there early in the morning to watch the fish auction, which is really fabulous and interesting, be sure to eat at one of the local sit-down places because they have the best fish there. They have unbelievably great fish there at the Tsukiji Fish Market. So agree totally. The other thing I love to do is just go to a local market and see what's in season, what's fresh. And you can get the cheapest feast almost anywhere in the world is some local cheese, some local bread, and some local fruit.
Mm.
And you take that to a little park, and you're in heaven.
When you're trying to get a good value, in India, I find that I become a temporary vegetarian. It just seems like I'm going with the flow, and these vegetarian thalis are just a delight.
Yes, yes, and I agree. And I think there are so many places where what's sold at the roadside food stands, like Singapore, for example, has an incredible wonderland of great food stands. And you're not eating off of fancy china with silver cutlery. You're eating off of plastic and paper. And it's delicious. It's a feast. It's really fresh ingredients and beautifully prepared. And, you know, America has the equivalent of that now with the taco truck scene or the movable feasts that go around. Portland has a lot of these.
You live in the Bay Area, and I remember driving up, what is it, International Boulevard in Oakland?
Yes, exactly.
Oh, it's incredible. I wish I had a bigger stomach, you know. You could stop at each one of those taco trucks, and I don't know what the trick is, but they are very good. I'm Rick Steves. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Don George, who has edited together a collection of 38 essays by great travelers, famous and not so famous, all coming together for just like a 38-course meal around the world. The book's called A Movable Feast, Life-Changing Food Adventures from All Over the World. Our phone number is 877-333-7425. You can email us at radio@ricksteves.com. Monica's on the phone in Issaquah, Washington. Monica, thanks for your call.
Hi, Rick. Well, I think it's so interesting because I used to live in Japan, too. I think, as Don said, it is exactly the heart of the culture. And I think also that Japan is, or especially like Tokyo, it's like the Paris of Asia because there's so many wonderful cuisines and it's so beautiful. And, you know, if you're willing and open, you can make a lot of friends because, you know, food is what Japanese talk about. It's like you say, hello, how's the weather? We say, they're like, oh, look at this dish. Where did it come from? And there's so many different kinds of regional dishes, even like what they call ekiben, which is every time you go to a station, they have a different kind of bento box that you can enjoy that particular area's cuisine.
So these are little balsa wood boxes that you get a to-go lunch for the train ride. Is that the idea, with delicacies in the little compartments?
Yeah, and sometimes they can even be a pot.
I love that. Kind of thing. That was one of my favorite things about riding the trains.
Yeah, mm. Yeah.
Don, you married a Japanese woman. Did you just marry her for the food?
No. There were so many reasons that I married her, but certainly the food was among them.
It was a plus.
It was a plus. It was definitely a plus.
Well, I married a Japanese person, too, and I think he lured me by taking me to these restaurants with just this wonderful food. And here we are 25 years later, and we're making lefse here at home today.
You're making lefse.
Oh, nice.
Lefse, yes.
Well, now there's an interesting juxtaposition, Norwegian food and Japanese food. I almost married a Japanese woman, and some of my favorite memories in Japan were going to these outdoor sake stands in the winter with tarp around them to keep people warm with those lanterns. Have either of you had that experience?
Oh, yes.
The sake, definitely. And you don't know how many glasses you've drunk because they keep filling it up.
Right. Yeah. And they're so small that you just down them immediately.
Yeah, you just think, oh, this is harmless.
Right, exactly.
Yes,
I love those outdoor stands, and they have things bubbling in pots that they will, you know, spoon out for you, and you eat them, and they're all delicious, and you don't know what you're eating, and you're drinking and talking. And yeah, that's a very quintessential memory of Japan for me.
Monica, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
And Jacqueline's on the line in Petaluma, California. Jacqueline, thanks for your call.
Oh, hi. How are you doing?
Doing well. Do you have a thought about food around the world?
Yeah, I was in Portugal a couple of years ago for the Feast of St. Anthony, and I'll tell you, sardines were in season, and I had the best dinner I ever had in my life, I swear to you, in a weird little garden behind a funny little bar. eating on a plastic table out of a paper plate with a plastic fork and a plastic glass. They were grilling fresh sardines on a funky old barbecue. And I'll tell you, those sardines were the best thing I ever ate.
Now, this was in Lisbon?
Yeah.
In the Feast of St. Anthony. Was it in the Alfama?
Yes.
I love the Alfama and the Feast of St. Anthony. That is just a carnival of sensory delights, eating, music, people, lights, color.
It was beautiful. And they sponsor a bunch of brides and grooms who have no money. The city sponsors them, and so there was a parade of brides going through the city during the day in old-fashioned convertible cars. It was adorable.
Now, that's a good example, I think, right there, Jacqueline. We're talking about how mundane, simple food can take on a magical kind of experience in the big context. You've got a festival going on in the most colorful corner of a very colorful city, Lisbon. And it's the whole context, I think, that made those sardines a little better than they probably really were.
Oh, yeah. It was perfect.
Don, do you know what I mean?
I love it.
I mean,
yes,
if I got those a plate of sardines like that, they could be the best sardines around. But, you know, at a strip mall in Seattle, yeah, yeah. I don't think it'd be quite the same.
You're not going to call up a radio show to say.
There we were, you know, out in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of the night, midnight snack of these gorgeous little sardines. And we ate them like corn on the cob. Made a pile of bones in the middle of the table. Oh, my God, it was fun.
I remember being in a Fado club in the Alfama eating sardines. And that was great because there you have all that Fado, that musical kind of energy. I remember it was a steamy restaurant packed out, well-worn old Fado singer there on a stool. And the kitchen staff was all gathered around the tiny little window between the restaurant and the kitchen. And it was like four heads crammed into this little hole, backlit with all the cooking going on and the steamy room and fisherwomen carrying rustic plates of sardines to all the people enjoying the music. And it was a $4 dinner. And it was one of the most magical travel experiences that'll stick with me for the rest of my life.
Amazing.
Jacqueline, thanks for your call and happy eating.
Thank you.
I'm Rick Steves. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We've been talking with Don George, who's edited a new book called A Movable Feast, Life-Changing Food Adventures from Around the World. Don, you wrote that assembling this collection of food stories from all these different writers was actually a transformative experience. It made you look at things differently.
Well, the moment I realized that was when I caught myself singing in the kitchen as I was chopping up some carrots and just preparing a meal one night, and I thought, wow, I've really learned to appreciate food. It's just kind of gotten inside me, and now I find when I go to a restaurant, I chew more thoughtfully and more carefully, and I really taste the different flavors. And it's just made me realize more than ever that food is a communion of things. It's what you're eating, but it's also the love and care that went into the preparation and went into the serving, and it's the camaraderie of sharing a meal with people you love. And put all of that together and you have the unbelievable feast that is every meal, really, that we make and serve and consume together. And that's really what the book celebrates, is that communion of love and nourishment that brings us together.
Wow. Don George, A Movable Feast. Happy travels.
Thank you, Rick. Bon appétit.
Bon appétit.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced at Europe Through the Back Door in Edmonds, Washington, by Tim Tatton with Sarah McCormick. Keith Stickelmeyer read today's travel haiku, and our theme music is by Jerry Frank. Special thanks to our colleagues at the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism for their help this week. You'll find many of the interviews from past editions of the show arranged by the countries we discuss. They're available as podcasts and as apps that you can download to your portable player or smartphone. Look for the Rick Steves Audio Europe link on the front page of our website at ricksteves.com. And join us again next week for more Travel with Rick Steves.